So the first speaker this morning will be Charlie Schroeder. He's a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University and also with the Nathan Klein Institute. And this group does a lot of work on, as you'll see, on surveying with high channel count recordings what happens spatially and across modalities and linking neural dynamics to stimuli and behavior. And so the talks will be 35 minutes. We'll have 10 minutes for questions. So the goal will be to have some real discussions and so on. And without further ado, Charlie.
Good morning, everybody. If I step away from the thing and become inaudible, make frantic motions at me, and I'll try to get my face back in front of it again. You might say that there's kind of an overall theme that I'm going to be pushing today, and it contrasts a little bit with yesterday because we heard a lot of really, really neat work on the higher frequencies mostly. And I'm going to come at it differently. And what I'd like you to understand in advance is that this isn't a either or, it's a both from my perspective. But I am going to come from the low frequency side and talk mostly about a thing I call rhythmic mode processing. And I think that contrasts in terms of basically a behavioral state with the situation in which you see that very constant kind of high-frequency activity, that which what I would call a vigilance mode. I'll hit that again as I go. So there's a lot of external rhythm in the world. Lots of examples here, and here are a few. Whoops, back to that, sorry. So. You know, the physical world has rhythm. There's examples of nesting that you see all over the place, like nesting of small waves on top of big waves in the ocean. And that looks surprisingly like the brain. Then whenever there are biologically generated stimuli, very likely there's some kind of rhythm involved. Think about watching a person walk across a room or listening to somebody speak. These are very rhythmic kinds of enterprises, and those are kind of external rhythms. There's then internal rhythms, okay? So we heard a lot about this yesterday, and everybody in this room knows a lot about oscillations already, so I'm not going to bore you with any of the simple details. But just to remind you, the thing that people talk about a lot is this rhythmic shifting of excitability here, right? So there's what we would call a good phase or an ideal phase and a non-ideal phase in terms of the excitability of the local neuronal ensemble, whatever the heck that is, right? And that's an interesting side to it. The thing that causes these neurons to synchronize and to oscillate in whatever frequency they're oscillating in or whatever combinations of frequencies they're oscillating in is not what I'm going to talk about. That's a fantastic topic, and I really hope we're going to make some progress on that to supplement the progress that people like Nancy and Miles have made on that topic. I'm going to talk about how these rhythms contribute to brain operations. So, in active sensing. Now, active sensing is basically an idea that just reinforces what we already know, which is that most of what you get, you looked for. You actively acquired. So in your hand, you don't sit around and wait for things to fall on it, except in a laboratory or when you're trying to see if it's raining. What you do is you reach out and you touch things. You touch surfaces. You palpate. You manipulate objects. So that's all predictable. All the somatosensory input that comes in came because you asked for it. Right? And there are beautiful patterning of these motor behavioral sequences by a variety of different oscillations. Whisking and sniffing in rats, beautiful. I mean, that's sniffing in particular. You know, it's really, you know, you'd have to blow the air, like in a laboratory, they blow the air up the rat's nose, right? Otherwise, you have to wait for them to sniff. There has to be muscular action to get air to cross the mucosa. Right? And that's often theta patterning and really more complicated than that because there are different modes. Saccadic sampling. Beth did some really neat work on this and showed a bunch of this yesterday morning. Here's a really neat example. This is from, is there another pointer around here? Can everybody see? Well, okay, so this is the work of Jarvis. And basically what he does is he has subjects to look at this picture, just free view, look at it however you want to, and then answer questions, okay? So what's the wealth of the family? What's the age of the family, of the people? Thank you. right? What were they doing before the unexpected guest returned? What's their clothing? How long was that person away? Each one of those questions that they have makes predictions about where they need to look, right? And what they're looking for, and so on and so forth. As Beth pointed out, these tend to be rhythmic, right? In this case here, they're moving their eyes at 4 to 5 hertz, right? Okay, so again, there's predictions, what, where, when. And the when is what I'm really going to talk about. The what and the where are really interesting. And I hope we'll get to that soon. One of the things that my lab has shown is that in the dark, if you watch up monkeys moving their eyes around, each time they drop their eyes on a spot, in other words, each time they fixate, that would be the dots here, there's this reset of excitability activity in the system to a high excitability state, which facilitates, we think, the transmission of information that happens to fall on the retina just then. Our data indicate that, wow, this is great. So, could I have another pointer? Yeah, that's good. That's good. This does seem to happen not just at the level of V1, as we published earlier, but really all over the system. Ongoing work in our lab is showing that in a really interesting way. And of course, Beth has shown this is working at the level of the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex. Okay, so this is active sensing. This is motorically driven sensing of the environment. And this is a visual example. This is deeply related to covert sensing. And what I'm going to do, given the time, I'm not going to really go into this. I'm going to go right to covert sensing because I think it's easier to make some of the points I want to make there. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about first is monkey experiments in a specific paradigm, which is this intermodal paradigm. We've been using variations on this paradigm for years now, and we're still using variations on it. It's kind of interesting because it allows you to do interesting things. In this case, what we're talking about are two streams of input. There's beeps and flashes. The beeps are occurring at about 1.5 hertz, but they're highly jittered. And for example, in one case, what the monkey would do is pay attention to the beeps, and it would be beep, 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 boop. They release the hand switch, and then they get a reward. Okay, they keep their eyes focused on the screen the whole time. And then in the case of the flashes, it would be flash, 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 and then there would be an oddball and response. So this is classic attention, right? You can look at the response to the flashes or the beeps when they're attended versus ignored. Okay. Now the prediction is, of course, that you're going to entrain a low-frequency oscillation to the flashes, to the visual stream. So high excitability phase aligns with the events in the visual stream when that's the attended stream. And then you just shift that over to do the auditory attention task, right? So shifting it back and forth allows you to use that oscillation as an instrument to facilitate your processing. And it's a prediction, right? If things don't occur on sequence, the system isn't going to work as you hope it will, right? Now, the way we measure these things is using these linear array multi-electrodes that Ed mentioned at the beginning. They sample from all the layers at once, and if you tracked Pascal's talk yesterday, you see there's a lot of good reasons to do that. What's going on in different layers is really important for distinguishing, say, feed-forward from feedback and lateral and various other kinds of inputs. We can also do now with the newer electrodes pharmacology. I won't talk about that today, but we're having great fun with that. And electrical stimulation. That's always been possible, but we hadn't taken advantage of that until recently, and I'll talk about that briefly today. Now, the way that we do this is we put two or even three of these electrodes in areas that we think are interconnected so that we can look at not just the local profile, but interactions between areas. Again, if you track Pascal's talk, you see why that's an important thing to do. And this is just an example of what a profile looks like in primary auditory cortex. So this is a laminar profile of event-related LFPs, local field potentials, recorded across the layers. And if you have an eye for this, you can see that there's a lot of voltage gradient over there. We simply take a second derivative approximation which measures this kind of laminar voltage gradient over time, and it gives you an index of the location, direction, and density of the transmembrane currents that generate that profile. So this is now indexing synaptic activity, and you know the laminar LFP profile does that, but this does it in a little bit more a straightforward analytic way. It's got some assumptions. It's not perfect, but it's not bad. If you record the multi-unit activity from all the contacts at the same time, just a few are shown here, then you can interpret these current sources and sinks as indices of net local excitation and inhibition, right? Yeah. So it gives you an index of cellular population because you know what layers different cell populations are in, as well as these neuronal processes. Now, here's the same thing, but with a single trial. So instead of averaging across trials as I did in the last case, this is a second and a half of activity, free-running, spontaneous activity, what was referred to as resting state. So as far as we know, this is in a quiet room, and there's nothing stimulating the monkey. This is just ongoing activity. And what you're seeing here is a theta oscillation, right? So that alternating source sync up in the superficial layers is a theta oscillation. It's a little harder to see, but there's a delta oscillation. You can now see the phase amplitude coupling. So theta amplitude goes up at this phase of delta. And here's a gamma oscillation. And those are trivially apparent all the time. So it's not like you have to say, well, is this really an oscillation? I mean, you can actually see this with your eye very often. So, and it's not that nothing's going on down here. It's just that the gain is set by this. This is the highest amplitude. So this is the wavelet spectrum of that sample of activity, and then this is a quantification of a much larger sample over a number of animals to show you that that's representative. Now, you know, there is some debate as to, you know, what layers are most important for different frequencies and so on and so forth, but I would say that this profile here, in terms of the laminar amplitudes of these different oscillatory frequencies at rest, right, this is pretty much representative of what we see in visual cortex and somatosensory cortex and auditory cortex. Okay, here's a quick movie to show you what this feels like in real life. Basically, what's happened here is all of the laminar ERPs, LFPs, are superimposed here in colored different colors. You can see that voltage gradient very nicely now. This is recorded from A1, and this is recorded from superior temporal polysensory area, another place that gets auditory in addition to other inputs. This is multi-unit activity, full-wave rectified from layer 4, so it gives you sort of a multi-unit histogram, if you will. So that's what it looks like online. You know, it's great fun to record these things. You can actually get a lot out of it by just watching it come in. Okay. All right, now, on to intermodal attention. So this is kind of a complex slide, but let me lead you through it. So this is a laminar profile of activity measured from V1, and everything is time-locked to a visual stimulus occurring at time 0. Same thing over here. This is attend visual, and this is attend auditory. The first thing that you can see is that there is a nice attention effect. There's a big amplitude enhancement. Especially in the superficial and inferior layers, supergranular and infragranular layers, due to attention. So if you look at this versus this, I hope that's very, very clear to you. And I'm not going to show you quantification, but trust me, that quantifies well. The other thing I'd like you to notice is that in the attend visual condition, this is already rolling in the right direction. When the inputs come from, so the inputs come through the thalamus up to layer 4C alpha and beta, those spiny stellate inner neurons project up to the superficial pyramidal cells, which are the major source of feed-forward outputs to higher-order visual areas. And what I'd like you to notice is that when that input comes up from layer 4 here up into the superficial layers, it's already rolling in the right direction here, right? And it's rolling in the wrong direction in this case, okay? So now if you look forward in time, or back in time, sorry, what you see is that this phase opposition is real and it's operative. It's actually just like that prediction I showed you, right? So the system, the ongoing activity, this activity in the superficial layers, tracks not the visual input, but which is attended, the auditory or the visual input. We've arranged them so that they're phase opposed, and you can actually see this. Note that layer four, the thalamic input region, is slave to the visual input. So it's tracking that. There's amplitude, but not phase modulation there, or not clear phase modulation. This is what you'd call an evoked response. This is really what you'd call an entrained response with that comparison. What this amounts to then is that attention can use phase coherence along. This is very much, this is sort of like an intra-aerial version of Pascal's coherence through, communication through coherence idea. This is basically using phase coherence to pass the information from layer four up to the feed-forward superficial layer pyramidal cells. And it's using phase opposition here to sort of cancel. So the idea then is that these predictions that the system is making, it's moving this oscillation around as a prediction, almost like a Woody filter, a template, these align the phases of activity in different layers and across different areas. That facilitates interlaminar and interaerial transmission. Now, I won't go into the interaerial, but if anybody's interested, we can talk about that later. Okay. Same thing happens in auditory cortex. Sorry. Again, I'll show you that later if you're interested. We've published a bunch of things on this. So the kind of questions that you would have about this, I hope, are, first of all, you know, I've shown you something happening in a network of neurons, a local network of neurons. So this is within a node in one of those big graph theoretic representations. Okay, does it operate across... do these entraining areas act as a network? Same paradigm, same predictions. Now what we're doing is recording from epilepsy patients. Now, Bob went into this in great detail yesterday. I won't repeat that. This is just all the electrode locations from our study across patients collapsed onto one hemisphere to show you the degree of coverage we have in this study. Okay, don't worry about the color coding. There's basically two types of effect here. One of them is from locations that have obviously read our papers, and they follow the prediction beautifully. So these are the raw data. These are all synced to auditory stimuli when they're attended versus ignored. These are just bandpass filtered to emphasize the point of interest. And these are polar plots that show that nice phase opposition. It's not perfect in some cases, and it's downright terrible. Well, it's still significant, but it's not as impressive in these cases. So that's the other type of effect. Now, in the ITC plots down here, what you can see is ITC at the rate of stimulation in these entrainment sites. These would be evoked sites, the other type. You can see nice evoked responses here, right, with your eye. In fact, they're more clear in the raw data than they are in the bandpass filter. And you see that the phase opposition, while it is, the phase plots show that there's kind of a phase modulation, but it's nothing like what you see in these cases. Also, you see this broadband increase in ITC, which is typical of an evoked response. So those are the two types that you see, and here's their distribution according to our study. So these, in this case over here, everything's organized by the size of the phase shift. So these big bright apples and cherries over here show locations where there's beautiful phase opposition. And they're occurring in very specific kinds of areas. It's happening all over, but it's especially clear in some places, like this kind of TPJ area, motor cortex. Primary motor cortex seems to get involved in a lot of this, superior parietal cortex, orbitofrontal cortex, et cetera. And those contrast with these more evoked response. So this is coded by the size of this, the percentage of the significant broadband phase locking values, right? These evoked responses occur in auditory and visual areas, not surprisingly. Okay, and this, I would say, this is basically a network. Now, there are some niceties to this that I'll gloss over, but it does look like this attention to time network that Kianobre and colleagues have described. Another question, where does this input that resets and entrains ongoing oscillatory activity originate from and how is it modulated? Okay, to cut to the chase, there's a number of candidates for this, right? Feedback, cortico-cortical feedback, right? Cortico-pulvinar cortical circuitry. And then there's this also this kind of cortical projections down to the thalamus and specifically to the nucleus reticularis and to the nonspecific regions of the thalamus near the primary sensory relay nuclei. In the auditory system, the MGV is like the LGN of the visual system. So it's the source of specific cochleotopic projections up into primary auditory cortex. Those happen to be positive for the calcium binding protein parvalbumin, and they project specifically to layer 4 of A1. And that's very much like the projections you see in the somatosensory system and the visual system, very specific. Then you have these so-called nonspecific, extralemniscal. Jones called them the matrix. They are positive for calbindin and a few others, but especially calbindin. These guys occur mostly outside the MGV, the dorsal and the magnocellular divisions in particular. They're also scattered around in locations near these nuclei. And they project up to layer 2 of the cortex, and they project very broadly, right? So, you know, they obviously haven't read the books on how these things work. I mean, they're kind of violating the rules. They don't respect hierarchy. They don't respect area very well. And they certainly don't respect the cochleotopic partition in auditory cortex. Same thing in visual cortex. They're nonspecific in terms of the retinotopic map in visual cortex, and they violate hierarchy continually. So these guys we're proposing are the drivers. They drive action potentials in auditory cortex. They carry information, specific information about things that are happening in specific parts of the receptor surface. And these are the modulators. They don't drive action potentials typically, but they affect the probability that appropriate driving inputs will. Okay, and as I say, they go to layers 4 and 2, 3. Okay. I cited some anatomical studies, which I can direct you to later if you're interested. Okay. Now, this is, I'm just going to show you briefly some what I would say are preliminary data, but they're very compelling, from something that Peter Lakatos is doing. What he wanted to do was to see if he could stimulate these so-called modulatory inputs and affect the handling of driving inputs in A1. You would like to do this with optogenetics. So far, we haven't seen a way to do that. So this is consider this a poor man's optogenetics. But it's surprising how well it works. So you put an electrode in A1, right, and measure across all the layers, and then you stimulate electrically in one of these target locations here. Now, this is just to remind you what a feed-forward profile of activation in A1 looks like. This happens to be broadband noise. But you see in the CSD plot, there's initial response in layer 4. And that's robust in the multi-unit activity here. You can see it's robust excitation. So these are driving inputs going to layer 4, driving action potentials. Okay. Here are modulatory inputs of various sorts. Now, this is a driving input. So this is, if you stimulate the source of these driving inputs here, right, you get, you know, this is kind of a wimpy profile, but it's not that bad. I mean, it starts in layer 4, and it's basically a robust excitation. So stimulating the ventral division of medial geniculate source of driving inputs gives you what looks like a driving input profile. If you stimulate any of these others that we think of as modulatory, you get this high superficial activation initially, and usually that's accompanied by some degree of inhibition, sort of a rebound excitation. So this looks modulatory. It doesn't look like a driving input. Same thing with the magnocellular division and kind of an interesting mixed effect from the thalamic reticular nucleus. If you stimulate these rhythmically, you drive this nice rolling oscillation up in the superficial layers especially, right? So this is something that's at least reasonable evidence for this idea that we've been pushing on this, and we'll go further with that. Another question. How well do these entrainment effects generalize across paradigms? So everything here has been from this one odd paradigm, these flashes and beeps going on all the time. It's a bit unnatural. We actually tried to structure it to be a bit like real life, but it is somewhat unnatural. So here's another example of a paradigm. Again, this is work from Peter Lakatosh. What he did was a classic auditory streaming paradigm. So two streams of beeps. One of them is going beep, 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 and the other one's going beep, 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 differing in the frequency of the tone and in the rate of presentation, right? And as in the other one, the monkey simply responds to the oddballs in the attended modality, in the cued modality, or in the cued stream, right? Again, a nice selective attention task, right? The cool thing about this is we didn't lock these things away from each other. And before we made them opposed, here they're allowed to kind of drift all over each other. So sometimes they're 180 degrees out of phase, right? And sometimes they're perfectly synchronous and variations in between. And that has a lot of beautiful sides to it that I'm not going to go into. But again, this paper just came out in Neuron. What you see, bottom line, is that there is entrainment at the rate of the attended stream. Thank you. Right? When the monkey's attending to this stream, the system entrains at that rate. When it attends to that stream, the 1.6 or 1.8 hertz, the auditory cortex as a whole, as far as we can tell, with our multi-electrode penetrations, when we're doing multiples here, usually two octaves apart, we can see that there's that entrainment at the appropriate rate. Again, a lot of other interesting things, including both sharpening of tuning and amplification of attended channels at appropriate frequency representations. We have a study in ECOG version of this, which has not yet been rejected. So we'll see how that goes. Here's another paradigm. This is a classic cocktail party paradigm. This has been a metaphor for attention and a lot of things for a long time, right? Basically, the question is, how does this guy lock into this woman's conversation and ignore these people? And in short, what he does is he gets on the same wavelength. I'm going to say that his brain entrains, enslaves to the prosodic rate, among other things, of the attended speaker, and that's how that works. This has come out just now as well. Okay, so this is basically two concurrent speakers videos. The subject looks at, right? So this is a multisensory, looks at and pays attention to one and ignores the other, right? In one condition, and they switch in the next condition, right? We're using long natural sentences, right? And the subjects are queried on content periodically, and we record ECOG. Here's a single trace to show you what the raw data kind of look like. In this case, two repetitions of the subject from one electrode position attending to the same speaker, meaning trial one, in the first trial they attend to the speaker, and then you record all the way through that for, in this case, 12 seconds. And then trial two attended the same. Here's the case where the subject is attending in trial one to one speaker and trial two to the other. And I hope you can see with your eye that there's a great deal of replicability in the first case and not in the second case. Now, what we did was we used this temporal response function. Bob mentioned this kind of obliquely yesterday. It's a way to get at how well the activity that you're measuring from the brain, how well that actually encodes the speech envelope. And as I told you in the other paradigm, there are two types of effect, both in low frequency phase and high gamma power, right? One of them is this evoked response-like effect. In this case, both these electrodes here are attending, are tracking the attended and the ignored stream at the same time, right? Both in low frequency phase and high frequency power, right? And then the second type is the more selective type. This, in this case, These electrodes are tracking the attended stream, maybe exclusively. There is a null hypothesis problem, but what I'll say is that we can't detect any significant tracking of the unattended, of the ignored stream, right? Same thing for low frequency phase and high frequency power. So there's information in both these cases. And what's really neat is that, now this is just the selective activity. If you look over time as the sentence unfolds, that tracking gets stronger and stronger in both cases, low frequency and high frequency, right? So we can talk about this in the discussion, but there's a mechanistic relationship between low frequencies and high frequencies. And if you look at how well these encode, how well these actually represent the speech envelope, what you see is that it's not they're not redundant. It looks like both of them are recording in, are sort of encoding information, and it seems to be at least somewhat complementary. So the best thing to do is analyze both of them if you want to decode the speech. Okay, second last question. Are these modulations of ambient rhythms or superimpositions of periodic evoked responses? Now, I showed you this. This argues kind of, you know, somewhat that there are entrainment and evoked response effects. Here's another thing. Now, I showed you this before as well, but I didn't tell you the cute trick that Peter played here. This was a catch trial, okay? The monkey is paying attention here all the way up to time zero, and at time zero, the stimulation stops. Now, the monkey, we think, thinks it's going to pick up again, so it keeps on making the prediction, and you can see this maintains beautifully for up, you know, this is 4 seconds after the end. Same thing for the other stream. Now, these can't be evoked responses, right? This is something that's been entrained, and so I think that argues strongly in favor of that side of the equation. Now, a lot of what we saw yesterday was non-rhythmic, and of course that's undeniable, right? And I think this is an effective task structure. So this is my artist's rendition of Pascal's data from 2001, his paper with Bob Desimone. Basically, what attention is doing is enhancing high-frequency synchrony and depressing low-frequency synchrony to make it simple. And I think that's an effective task structure. And we've been arguing that in a few different cases. There's a paper submitted that's in review right now that actually tests this behaviorally, and there's another that's in preparation. And of course, we want to test that electrophysiologically directly in addition to doing it indirectly. So what else should we be thinking about? I'm kind of winding up now. I talked about this. I'll say I did this very, very simplistically. I said, you know, there's an ideal excitability phase and there's a non-ideal, but there's really a lot more going on. If we know that inhibition leads to independence, decrease in local cross-correlation, right? And strong excitation leads to increased cross-correlation, decreased independence, or increased dependence, interdependence, if you will. Also, we know that attention decreases noise correlation. So if you have an ensemble that's kind of synchronized in some domain of some size, and it's oscillating, how much of this is going on here, right? We just talked about excitability in a very simple way, but really there's a whole lot more complex things going on there that I think we need to start really paying attention to. If you pay attention to these guys, they're really interested in these different modes of processing this so-called burst mode during high excitability, which is considered to be good for detection, and this tonic mode during lower excitability, which is good for discrimination. Now, these are typically noted in these slow fluctuations that you see in sleep and in some wake conditions, right? So up and down states, right? And these can transition, possibly, into events that are on the time scale of the fluctuations we're talking about here. So these are things we need to think about. There's also this idea of phase coding, spike phase coding of information. Would that only happen on this phase, or does it happen smoothly? Does it, you know, how is this working? And I think that's maybe a very important question for us to be answering, right? And then also, we've talked about these when predictions. What about other predictions like where and what, right? These, you know, spatial attention, feature attention, those are, these are things that involve predictions as well. And we need to really think about how system, our, we talk about this as it's parsing information, not really how it's encoding so much, right? And then another really big question, which I want to really highlight, is precisely what is going on. What membrane currents are generating and distinguishing between frequency bands? Now, again, Nancy and Miles and others have done some really neat work on this so far. And yeah, I'm hoping that we'll get involved in this and make some additional progress. So, and then the last little question down here is, what's the most basic cellular domain? We discussed this the other day during Nancy had us over there for a Vulcan mind meld, and while she was torturing us, we got to talking about how big is the, what's the smallest domain? Is it a Mount Castle mini column, right? And do a lot of these things aggregate and disaggregate, probably dynamically, all the time, right? That's going to be a fun thing to understand. So this is just sort of an additional summary. So what I'd like to encourage people to do is look at the key rhythmic components of natural experience and behavior. I've given some examples. You know, if you have a task that has a cadence, it would be great to understand what that cadence is doing and how it's parsing the brain's behavior, if you will. This coordination of activity across ensembles, again, this has come up repeatedly. Well, I've emphasized low-frequency coherence, but it's really basically the same theme. This is all scaffolding for all kinds of brain operations. You know, this thing I just mentioned, all these different interesting cellular states, how much do they couple? Do they work at all the frequencies of interest, right? This idea of random... this rhythmic versus random continuous mode. Mentioned that already. Okay. And finally, this is what Peter Uhlhaus was talking about. The disorders of brain dynamics and different kinds of sensory and neuropsychiatric disorders. He focused again on the higher frequencies, and as you might imagine, we focus on the lower frequencies, and there's a great story to tell there as well. Okay, here's some acknowledgments. Peter Lakatosh, Yoshi Kajikawa, Noel O'Connell, Saskia Hoggins, Gabriella Mishakia. Tammy and Debbie are the people that are in charge of doing most of the animal medical care and the initial training. Then this is Jordi Costa Fidela and Jose Herrero, both of whom are here. Annie Barzek, who's doing the ongoing work in tracking eye or eye movements. These guys, I didn't really talk about their work. This is Troy Hackett, Arno Falkier, and John Smiley. They're doing the anatomy work in our, Arno's in our lab and the others doing it through collaboration. Julianne Bell, Benjamin Morion, Alana Zion-Golombic, Lucia Maloney, and then a host of people from NYU, LIJ, and Columbia that are involved in the ECOG work. And then a few more. Istvan Ulberg, who's the source of these U-probes that we use, and we interact with him a lot in trying to innovate and design new ones and do interesting things. Steve Bressler and Mingzhou Ding, who have been working with us in collaboration for computational work. And then I want to acknowledge both Nancy and Miles because they made me think about this a little bit differently the other day. And I think they're going to contribute even more to our work as time goes by. Thank you. Yeah, so, yes, I'll repeat. He asked me basically what's happening with eye movements and ongoing oscillations, correct? So what Beth showed yesterday morning was a reset of ongoing theta oscillation, right, in hippocampus and entorhinal cortex. What we see is a little bit more broad reset, lower frequencies as well as theta, very prominently theta, and including some higher frequencies. at the onset of fixation, and they stay, the reset sets them to a high excitability phase, which basically increases local excitability right after fixation. There's suppression during the saccade, right? And you can actually see that physiologically as well, right? And this is happening 4 to 5 times a second in visual search. So it's really parsing the input. It's putting this kind of rhythm in it, and it's sort of packaging, if you will, how the input goes into the visual system, as far as we can see.
Oh,
I see. I see. Okay, so okay, that's really interesting. There is some indication that some of this actually slops over into the auditory system. I didn't talk about that. But basically, in these tasks, we can track what's going on there as well. I'm going to be a little cautious about that. And I'll also say it's not just pure mechanics here. There's clearly an attentional component to this. And that's hard to pull away from this so-called corollary discharge idea, right? Yeah.
Some of the key points in the network you've identified, such as the temporoparietal junction, are important in the so-called default network, and that's identified in resting state fMRI, also via low-frequency coherence. Do you have any thoughts about the relationship between your network and that?
Yeah, so when the monkey's doing this task, I didn't show these data either. It's really strange. Even though performance stays, now this is not trivial, and it's not, they're not performing at ceiling, but as far as we can see, performance doesn't shift dramatically, but we still see slow fluctuations in across trials, right? So we're kind of piling this on top of these default mode and active mode switches that are presumably occurring in the background, right? And I didn't show you the data from that. And, you know, it's kind of a preliminary thing, but it looks really striking in some of the V1 data. You see these slow shifts occurring. Yeah. And they're, you know, on the order of 10, 20 seconds. Yeah.
Thank you.
The rhythm is always characterized as a sine wave. And when I looked at your images, they look to me more like boxcars and ramps. And I wonder if you take it out of the frequency domain and more into the time domain, if you can skull out kind of what's going on. Your loop with the MGP, it looked like things were going and then someone said, okay, we've got enough here, and yanks the cord. And you might see those better without taking all the harmonics away by seeing the boxcars.
Yes, yeah, and so, well, okay, so first of all, you know, we do see these in the real time data. I mean, you can really see that, and they're definitely not sine waves, right? They're asymmetrical. They have different slopes coming and going, but what you notice especially is if you have an entrainment in the case where the monkey, where we stop stimulating and just let it roll,
right?
That tends to look a little bit more sinusoidal as time goes by, right?
Sure.
But when there's a constant stimulation, that causes a reset on every single one, and that puts a sharp transient. And it's clearly also superimposing an evoked response.
So there's some actually extra information there.
Yes, absolutely. No, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about your data. First of all, I love your data. It's really, really nice and powerful. I loved your talk. But you talked about it setting up excitability phases. And in that first experiment that you showed, did you really see that it did that when you actually then had the stimulus? Because it looked to me like the amplitude of the response, if you line them up,
which,
was the same.
Which experiment?
This was the one where you attend auditory, attend visual.
Okay.
And presumably the attend visual, you should be in the right excitability phase to get a greater response. Did you actually see that?
Yes. Here we go. Okay. So this is, I think this is where we're talking about, right?
So the red is attend visual.
This is attend auditory. And my point was that in the case of the attend visual, this ongoing activity is already going in the right direction. That's the prediction, the system's prediction. So it starts rolling high when it expects to be a little bit anthropomorphic, when it expects the input to go from layer 4 up to layer 3. And it's rolling low in the other case because the system is lining up to the timing of the auditory stimuli. So now the auditory stream is attended, and that's orchestrating, you know, this oscillation, basically, right?
So what I'm wondering is, can you tease apart how much of it is actually coming from the phase and not just the fact that I'm attending, I've got a lot of activity versus not a lot of activity, and how much is the phase of the oscillation giving you more bang for your buck when you hit the system? I don't know if you can tease that apart with...
I'm actually not sure I totally understand the question, so maybe we should talk about it.
You just look on the left, you look on the right. Attend, you have a lot more activity, both before and after the stimulus comes in. So you could say that's just because you're attending this more cholinergic. Versus, I'm at the right phase to get a bigger response.
There's definitely amplitude modulation as well as phase modulation occurring here. I think some of the amplitude modulation is tied to phase modulation, right? So let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, that's a pretty complicated matter. Yeah. And I'd be glad for your input on that. Pardon? Well,
I think it's a fine question that modeling might actually help with, to try to tease out those different aspects of the modulation going on here. Right.
Yeah. What I would say is really curious and interesting is the fact that this modulation, this phase modulation, is so strong in primary visual cortex, right? Because this was really unexpected to us. When we first did this, it sounds like we predicted this from the beginning. Actually, no, we didn't. We made this up. No, this happened, you know. But the predictions started to come a little later when we finally came to grips with what we were seeing, right? And the same thing with what would do this. This, you know, drives our thinking about circuits. There's some circuits that go there that are likely candidates, right? And that's why we started getting interested in thalamic stimulation of this. So, yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot of little facets to this to tear apart.
It is doing something. I just don't know how we tease that apart from the other things that are happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can maybe tease apart at least what circuits are causing it. And frankly, you know, what Peter's doing in auditory cortex with this technique, with this stimulation technique, is he's disrupting. He's pushing against attention with it, right? And again, it's like a poor man's optogenetics. It's kind of messy, but it's amazing how well that seems to be working. And by the way, if you stimulate MGV, you can simulate you sort of make an artificial driving input, right? So you could forget about what the monkey wants to do, and you could just, you know, manage all this stuff and see what happens. And of course, that's already being done. Yeah, that's probably not going to get it all. But and then of course, what we were talking about the other day, we can now pharmacologically modulate some of this, so we can really get at some of the physiology there. And that's not really what you're talking about completely, but it's a part of it. Yeah.
All right. So maybe we can have some of the discussions in the break. And let's thank Charlie again. Yeah.